Okay, I think we should start. I know there'll be a number of other folks joining us on Think Tank Time, but we should try and start as close to tiempo inglés as possible here. So I think we'll, since my friend Andrew Preston is here from the UK, I want to, follow the, we'd say in Argentina, tiempo inglés. We want to try and start close to on time as possible. So I'm really quite pleased to have my friend and colleague Mark Lagon here with us. He has an international relations chair at Georgetown. He's also an adjunct senior fellow for human rights at the Council on Foreign Relations. He also had the rank of ambassador overseeing the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons Office at the State Department until January of 2009, where he, if you follow this issue, it's really one of the most important jobs in the State Department. And is really, I think, has been something that's been a bipartisan issue over probably a 10 or 12 year period. And Mark has been at the center of shaping and working on this incredibly important human rights issue. So it's been a privilege and a joy to work with Mark and having a professional association with him. But I also consider him a friend and colleague. Mark has this very interesting idea, and one of the reasons I'm interested in it is here at CSIS is we've been doing a number of things looking at democracy and governance, economic growth and development. I think there have been a number of very interesting studies. There's a book called The Democracy Advantage, as well as a book, a report, I thought a very interesting book, a report by Steve Radlett and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf on emerging Africa that came out a couple years ago, which I think was a landmark study looking at the five factors of how African winners are emerging, and one of them is around democratic governance. So with that as the, and so with that as sort of the additional things, we just have gotten a grant here at CSIS to look at the democracy and governance economic growth nexus within the bureaucracy. I think the thinking, the theory of this is all there, that there's a positive correlation. It's important we ought to be thinking. But the way that the bureaucracies, whether it's the World Bank or AID, thinks about democracy and thinks about economic growth are two very different beasts, that they don't intertwine, they don't interact. And so there are some bureaucratic reasons for that. There are some legislative reasons for that, and we want to get it to what those are and to fix that. And so I have a strong interest in this. When Mark said to me, Dan, the other thing I think we should be thinking about is there have been some proposals on the table to, as we think about the MDGs 2.0. You're familiar with the Millennium Development Goals, and they're going to be up in 2015. There have been some very thought. Paul Wolfowitz has come out and suggested that we ought to have some MDGs around governance or have some specific things around governance. I think governance is going to be an incredibly important part of the development conversation going forward. The work of Douglas North, my wife's favorite economist, or if you look at his Violence and Social Orders book in particular, but also the book that many of you are familiar with about Why Nations Fail by Acemoglu, talks about the power of institutions. So I think with all of that, when Mark came to me and said, I've got this very interesting idea about a global trust for legal rights, a global fund, if you will, for rule of law, I said, oh, my gosh, we've got to have you over here to have a discussion about this and invite the broader development community to the conversation, but also that it would be an excuse for me to have a little bit of a longer discussion with you about this, a little bit in public as well. So,
sure.
But I think, and with that, I'm going to turn it over to you, Mark, and then I give you a little bit of time to speak, and then I'll provide just a few minutes of reaction or just quiz you a little bit based on the conversation, then we'll open it up.
I'm nervous.
Oh, my word. Okay, Mark, over to you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure working with Dan, who's one of the more creative people in Washington and with his experience working at the IFC and elsewhere in Washington at how partnerships work and sometimes don't work. The UN General Assembly every year opens up with themes, and this year's high-level segment of the UN General Assembly, thanks to the imprint of Ban Ki-moon, was on rule of law. I don't know whether the UN has had a transformative impact in its substantial work on rule of law. It's had some good impact, but I'm here to suggest that perhaps a larger partnership fund incorporating other actors might be the better way to go. In fact, patterned after the Global Fund to Fight HIV/AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Why rule of law? Well, I'd like to go into this a little more deeply, but it strikes me that, you know, rule of law in practice, actually enjoyed, is the key for the world's poor to economically thrive. It's a potential catalyst for economic growth. And the problem about rule of law in the world is it so often exists on paper, in treaties, in laws, but not as much in practice implemented. And I was struck in my own teaching at Georgetown and thinking at the Council on Foreign Relations by the similarity of thinking between two different voices on the left and the right on this thought. And I just want to share this with you. So the former Secretary General of Amnesty International globally, Irene Kahn, in her book, The Unheard Truth, Poverty and Human Rights, writes the following. A farmer is poor to the extent that he or she lacks money to feed their family, but farmers are also impoverished if their control over the land that they till is subject to the whims of a feudal landlord or corrupt government official. Law is essential both as a shield against the kinds of harm that cause or perpetuate poverty and as a weapon for helping people increase their freedom. Legal empowerment is about using that shield and wielding that weapon. And the irony is that for most people living in poverty, the law is often not a liberating force but a means of oppression that perpetuates their deprivation, exclusion, insecurity, and voicelessness. That's a voice from the left. On the right, not long ago, Gary Haugen, the head of International Justice Mission, perhaps one of the most effective faith-based NGOs that there is and heavily focused on fighting human trafficking but other forms of violence against the global poor, wrote in Foreign Affairs an article called "And Justice for All." It's remarkable that this voice from a different part of the political spectrum sounds awfully similar. He writes, "For a poor person in the developing world, it's a struggle to avoid extortion or abuse by local police, the struggle against being forced into slavery or having land stolen, the struggle to avoid being thrown arbitrarily into an overcrowded, disease-ridden jail with little or no prospect for a fair trial. The problem for the poor is that laws are rarely enforced. Without functioning public justice systems to deliver the protections of the law to the poor, legal reforms of the modern human rights movement rarely improve lives of those that need them most." And pertinent to aid, Haugen notes, the absence of functioning public justice systems for the poor also jeopardizes half a century of development work because there's no effective mechanism to prevent those in power from taking away or blocking access to the goods and services the development community is providing. Those are two remarkably similar visions about why rule of law is crucial to prosperity and crucial to human rights at the same time. So what is rule of law? Rule of law consists of procedures that give all members of society, whether they be women or minorities or some groups sometimes excluded, meaningful access to justice without either corruption or discrimination standing in the way. And it's often seen as a human rights issue, but it is, as those in the development community focus on, particularly Amartya Sen, it is the thing that allows people to tap their capabilities, and use them. Think, for instance, if in this incredible economic miracle, India, how much more of an economic miracle it would be if those who are in the most disadvantaged castes, such as the Dalits, were not subject to the possibility of being in bonded labor or various forms of exploitation because the laws on the books since the mid-1970s are not regularly implemented to give them equal access to justice. Think, too, how much more productive Arab and Middle Eastern governments would be if they didn't only rely on the riches of fossil fuels, but were to unleash the asset of women as workers and entrepreneurs if they were not denied regularly their rights, not treated as having full access to justice under the law. So the key is, how do we go from elegant treaties that nations have ratified and laws on the books, but that aren't actually implemented? Human rights institutions often aren't focused on capacity building. The UN Human Rights Council, for all of its strengths and its sins, is not very good at advancing capacity for rule of law. The International Criminal Court, impressive in many ways, controversial in others, it's about post-facto accountability for war crimes, not about preventive issues. The UN, it has 40 entities that have been working in some 110 nations for some 20 years, doing some good work on rule of law. But is it moving the needle? Bruce Jones, a scholar at Brookings and New York University's Center on International Cooperation, headed up a report in which he said these rule of law efforts in the UN tend to be superficially consultative, focus narrowly on program outputs rather than on the attainment of broader goals, and seldom based on a real theory of change. So what do we need? We need to have a more nimble facility that can bring in civil society actors and private sector actors, which will never be fully integrated in partnerships that are chiefly run by intergovernmental organizations. If something is run or sitting in an intergovernmental organization, it will always be subject to some of the lowest common denominator parochial interests of member states. And so I propose that we need something I would call a global trust for rule of law. And you may wonder why trust. You'll see in a moment, as opposed to the word fund. But the idea is to leverage different partners, developing nations, developed nations, intergovernmental organizations, international financial institutions, NGOs, and business entities. And this fund would provide grants for establishing meaningful access to justice, training prosecutors, training judges, making people aware of the ways to seek redress for corruption. And the reason I suggested it might be called a trust is not just the meaning a fund, but in fact, it's all about building trust. Irene Kahn says that people don't actually trust the law because of corrupt officials. So part of it is to create societies of trust. Governments and intergovernmental organizations would be essential for convening meetings to bring together this trust and to provide seed money. Businesses have to be part of the picture. They have a distinct interest in predictable rule of law for investing in countries. And if they are involved from the outset, it would make skeptical governments actually want to ask for help for rule of law capacity building, because there might be an increased prospect of larger business involvement and investment. I was asked by Richard Haass, when I wrote a draft paper as the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, he needed to approve it. He said, why not just have an alliance of NGOs? And my response is, if there was an alliance of NGOs, much as they are some of my closest friends in the world, there would be a reaction on some member states, in fact, some democratic member states of the UN, to deflect something that was merely an NGO alliance without business at the table as well. The UN, I'm suggesting, is insufficient to do the job here, but it is very much necessary for providing a kind of neutral, procedurally based definition of rule of law, and to lend legitimacy and an imprimatur to a partnership. So how would you construct this global trust? I have two models in mind, one of which obviously is the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. And from that I draw the lessons that you want to look at. How do you bring in the comparative advantages of the private sector and foundations into an effort, and avoid some of the problems of assigning an agency in intergovernmental organizations a job that might have some equities? There was a reason why the job of a major fund on HIV/AIDS was not just assigned to the World Health Organization. But a second model that is lesser known, but I've been exposed to, is the UN Democracy Fund. The UN Democracy Fund is a trust fund of the Secretary General of the UN, and it its donors and a number of experts and regional powers are on a governing board. It is not beholden to the budget of the UN General Assembly. And from it, I draw the lessons of getting an imprimatur from a leading universal membership organization like the UN, UN Democracy Fund, but a nimbleness in focusing on civil society actors. Because the way the creation of this fund was negotiated, 85% of its grants would go to implementers who were not UN agencies, mm-hmm. which is to say to NGOs and civil society organizations. And that's what I think a global trust should emphasize. Structurally, I think there should be a board which has developed countries, developing countries, UN and international financial institutions, NGOs, foundations, and private sector actors. And there should be a regional distribution of seats on that governing board so that there is no way that one can point to a Western bias. And no one nation or entity or business or foundation should be able to give more than 10% of the resources or have more than 10% of the say on the board. And it would be a technical committee of experts from different regions of the world who are specialists in rule of law who would make judgments about the grant proposals of how the money would be spent. Grants would be performance-based and only distributed in tranches after certain targets are met. And let's remember that we've got to make sure that the money is well spent and accounted for. If you're to have something called the trust and you're supposed to build accountable rule of law, this entity would have to be, have high standards, have the strongest of inspectors general. Let's recall there have been some questions about the Global Fund for HIV/AIDS that have led some countries to pull back. So there are plenty of organizations. Maybe it's the American Bar Association's Rule of Law Initiative that trains people around the world. Maybe it's the organization Bachao Andolan, which is an anti-child labor group in India that could be supported. Even working with governments to try and fight corruption in places like Nepal and El Salvador. This kind of trust fund, despite the degree to which the United States seems to be putting itself on the couch about its role in the world and how powerful it is or is not, this cannot happen, in my view, unless the United States, working with other states, pushes for this initiative. The United States is necessary to broker creation of such a fund and to put seed funding on the table. But I do think it's very important for some leading developing world power to be a co-partner with the United States, at least in the initial discussions. Brazil, Indonesia, Turkey, perhaps. There will be skeptical states, and it's important to work through things in a negotiation about a procedural definition of rule of law, something that is not co-equal with Western-style democracy only, and make it clear that this could not be structurally a Trojan horse for willful U.S. policy manipulation, even though the United States very much has an interest in this, because of the limited funds and say coming from any player. So, to wrap up, I think that there actually can be money found for this and that the United States can actually put money on the table. Let's look at the fact that money, since the financial meltdown in 2008, the United States and Japan have actually been increasing the money that they've been putting into the Global Fund to fight HIV/AIDS. And a case can be made even to legislatures in the United States and Europe that this Global Fund could be a multiplier, have a multiplier effect for prosperity, pluralism, and peace. And I'd love your feedback on whether this has the potential for being as much of a nimble catalyst as I hope it would be. The devil is, of course, in the details, and help me with that. But I would make the case this could be a high-value bargain for the world and for the United States, worthy of an investment.
Mark, thanks very much. It's very, very interesting. Just to sum up what you said for those who may have come in late, that what you're suggesting is either a fund that is sort of secretariated, if you will, within the UN system, similar to the Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, Malaria, for rule of law. You don't call it a global fund, you call it a global trust, and you make that definition. Or alternatively, something that's akin to the UN Democracy Fund, for those of you that are familiar with the UN Democracy Fund. I have a couple comments about this, and then I know there's some thoughtful people in the room that I do certainly think this is timely. I think that both the fact that Ban Ki-moon is signaling something, I do think it's good that when the UN, they have a different kind of imprimatur, and they're in some ways like the secular papacy for a lot of people, and they take them they provide an imprimatur that's very powerful and important. So I think that for Ban Ki-moon, I think as a pro-democracy person, he knows, he's experienced moving from autocracy to democracy, so I know he understands the power of this. And so to the extent within his constraints, I do believe he tries to work within those for the most part and has been, so I think that's a good sign. Just some thoughts, having thought about, I think this is probably more akin to the UN Democracy Fund, only in the sense that when I think of Gavi or the Global Fund, these are sort of big health funds that oftentimes run money through the pipes of governments. That these are not necessarily grant-making institutions, mm-hmm. that this is more along the lines, in my mind, of the UN Democracy Fund. The other caveat I would have is I think most companies, having worked with a lot of corporates in corporate philanthropy on partnerships for development, run away from this per se, or depending if it's democracy or human rights, they get really skittish. There are a subset of companies like GE comes to mind where they're very interested in things like how do we fund alternate dispute resolution other than the courts, or how do we improve sort of commercial law or sorts of things that make it important for trade or investment to happen, especially foreign direct investment. So I do think who you put on the private sector side will be tricky. I can see some companies wanting to do this. I think there are probably some former business people, retired chair of a board, somebody who's got sort of global stature I'd put on the board as opposed to necessarily looking for funding from corporates for this. I do think this is going to be more likely, if you were to get funding for this, I think it's probably perhaps a little bit naive to think that you're going to be able to get equal amounts of funding from various sources. I think for you to do this, in my mind, to make this significant, you'd be looking at sort of a $300 to $500 million fund. That's a lot of fundraising and a lot of donors. You could do this more easily if you said to the American government, why don't you do 100, go to the polls and have them, you know, do 20, and go to a series of European donors and ask, you know, do between sort of 10, 20, 30, or 50, depending on how seized they are with the idea, and then try and raise another $100 million from philanthropy and maybe some companies. But I think this is going to be primarily a government, at first, at the very least, it'll be a government thing, is my sense, and I think you might find a variety of mechanisms around the governance to make it in such a way. I mean, there's a variety of contorted governance structures at the global fund, various global funds, to sort of reflect, how do I reflect different contributions, or how do I reflect different sorts of voices? So I think you can find a workaround for that, but I do think you will find it hard to get each person to sort of chip in an equal amount of money, sure. I just think. But I do think it's timely, I think it's interesting. It would seem to me that you could house this, you could repurpose the UN Democracy Fund to the extent that they're running well and say it's the Democracy and Rule of Law Fund and give it a new mission. That may be an easier way to do it, and looking on what it currently is, you know, creating a new institution could take 12 to 18 months. Just, I mean, if anyone's had an experience, especially a UN institution or some sort of a quasi-internet government, that's a good several-year project. If you wanted to do this quickly, you could go to the UN Democracy Fund and say, we're giving you a new mission in life. And in addition to democracy, the tricky thing there is if you say, I'm the Democracy and Rule of Law Fund, or some people are going to say, well, this is, I personally don't have a problem with this, but that this is sort of a reflection of American interests in trying to bring democracy to the world. I personally don't have a problem with this, but it may have a brand problem in certain parts of the world, I guess is how I would describe it. So that may make the only wrinkle to where you might want to, why you may not want to house it, the UN Democracy Fund. But if you wanted to do something quickly, that may be a place to do it. But why don't I stop on my reflections, and I suspect there's some very thoughtful people in the room who will have some thoughts about this that may not have had a time to fully have digested everything that Mark has said or haven't read Mark's paper, but I do think I think there's some very interesting ideas on the table, and I'd welcome people's thoughts about it, and I'll stop there. And I'll take hands or I'll call on people. Andrew.
Thanks, Mark. I think it's great to see...
Andrew Preston is with DFID, and he's the Washington rep and here for DFID.
Sorry, I should have introduced myself, yeah. I think in terms of sort of highlighting the importance of rule of law, I'm totally on board with you, and I think it's really great to see you thinking on this. As you spoke, I think the thing I was asking myself was, what are some of the binding constraints and some of the challenges to making progress on rule of law at a country level? And to what extent would a mechanism such as this actually address these? And I suppose I came down to thinking about strong vested interests at a country level and a lack of commitment and political commitment to really push some of these things forward. And so I then find myself asking, how does a fund of this type actually start to address these? I mean, I think the difference with the kind of the global fund type model is that essentially you had commitment on all sides there, and the fund was actually partly about channeling that money down to a country level and ensuring it was effectively spent. So it'd be good to hear more from you on that. And then one other thought from my side, which is looking at different models and different sort of mechanisms. I mean, the other thing that I think is quite an interesting innovation is the Open Government Partnership, still in its early days. But what I think is interesting about that is that it focuses on individual countries and trying to strengthen their political commitment. And then through a kind of an international high-level political meeting and leveraging the White House especially, trying to kind of make countries live up to some of those commitments. So I suppose my question is, how do you deal with the politics of this and some of the sort of political economy of it?
Can you speak to either of those, if you would?
Sure. Great questions and comments. I mean, political will is really a crucial issue, and something that was the elephant in the room for me in writing this paper is, do you work only in permissive environments in which there are governments that are kind of welcoming the help? And even in those cases, there are going to be many elements at different levels of government where there isn't will, to marginalize corruption. Or do you actually even work in some countries where governments are resistant and assist civil society organizations? My own view here is there need to be public demands for change, for real rule of law. And there is a fatalism, a really terrible fatalism in the global poor, that legal institutions don't work for them, and they don't turn to justice institutions. This is informed for me by, spending about 4 years focused almost wholly on human trafficking, both in the government and heading an NGO. And, the problem is not just poverty and desperation that leads someone to be recruited into forced labor or into coercive prostitution. It's corrupt officials. If you are in this situation, your fear that if you take your case to the authorities, you'll either be talking to someone who has been paid off by the bad guy, or you'll be perceived as a dirty prostitute or an irregular migrant who's to be packed away and deported. And so there needs to be trust. And I do think that working with civil society organizations, not just for the actual capacity building and training, but the public demands, are necessary. I don't pretend this would be an easy task, but I do think sort of raising up this issue on the part of the international community is important. I agree with Dan, by the way. I think there has to be seed money from some leading powers. We can't just expect businesses and foundations to jump to this with huge resources. And I'm glad my good friend David Kramer, the head of Freedom House, is here. I sort of thought of the scale of the funding that the State Department's Bureau on Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, which he used to head, devotes to democracy, and I sort of thought that's about the amount that on top of that spending, the U.S. ought to put on the table about these days about $140 million.
Okay. Annually?
Annually.
Okay. Okay. And do you want to speak to the Partnership for Open Government?
The Open Government Partnership is, and you know, it's great that it has strong Soros support, is a very interesting idea, and it sort of combines the accountability mechanism with sort of high level politics. So I think it has some promise. I wouldn't suggest that this would displace it, but complement it.
Thelma.
I just wanted to kind of follow the same trend and look at the dichotomies. You know, you start out by setting the stage with the families who are trying to feed themselves and also trying to protect themselves. And your fund is focused initially on the trying to protect themselves part, whether that's from trafficking, from loose agrarian laws, and a number of other things. Also, the fund versus improving the focus of institutions that already have funds to address some of these issues, how to better create a model for addressing these key issues, because rule of law is becoming more and more of a popular focus. I do think also that there is a dichotomy, which you've already alluded to, between rule of law that is associated with feeding the family or improving growth within a country that's, addresses access to courts, that's also on the other side, but contract law, investment law, tax law, bribery and corruption. You would want to not set it up so it's versus individual rights protections. You want to see how this is going to move together. And then a bit of the dichotomy that you pointed out about how do you get political buy-in to this, because you do have governments who, let's just assume all governments have good hearts and are trying to do the right thing for their people. There's still going to be this wide range of priorities. How do we address these issues, and how do we increase our capacity to address these issues? And you may get resistance to that if you say, okay, the first place we start is to try to empower people to address their own poverty through, opposing the government. So how do you get people who have good intentions to not pull away from each other while they're trying to address similar goals? And then the one last dichotomy is efficiency versus, if you put something in a fund that's, AIDS is a big global objective, but if you look at OPIC and others who set up facilities and funds, MCC and others, you do restrict your flexibility a bit. And so I again reflect back to should effort be put into AID and other institutions that already have money to use it better, more efficiently, and have some flexibility in establishing those priorities, or should you put something over a separate fund? Mm-hmm. Rule of law is a big, big area, so maybe you won't have that inflexibility built into it. But I think you see what I mean there. When you separate something out to a fund that's only going to address a particular aspect of it, you take away some of your flexibility to meet needs as they arise.
Well, there's a lot there, so let me pick and choose a few things to emphasize. Different meanings of rule of law. I think that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. Clearly, a premise is to create economic prosperity. Some governments will not only be suspicious that the patrons of this fund have a broader democracy agenda, Western-style democracy agenda, but they will also be concerned about demands being made by the poor, and it in effect turning into political opposition. But I think that we need to make sure that we structure it in a way that it isn't somehow limited strictly to, you know, redress for economic, you know, problems or denial of access to justice, but the whole array of voice for people, you know, where the economic meets the political. I've been asked, so is this would this undercut a more pure democracy and democratic governance agenda? And my own view is that we need and by we I mean the United States, inside and outside of government, we need to think of a concentric circles approach. And, you know, I'm the first ardent advocate of a pure democracy promotion approach, and then a larger circle of human rights. And I see this as the largest circle for developing consensus. I actually see some of the problems you suggest as, in fact, representing an opportunity to create greater comfort with the building blocks of that chain of to human rights and democracy. Particularly, you're right, I think, Dan, that the initial seed money should come from member states. The prospect of having businesses in the mix is to reinforce this message, as I've argued. There's going to be much more investment in countries if rule of law is established more deeply in practice, and that is actually the interests of the states. So,
you might make the chair a former chair of, say, Coca-Cola, or something. You have some global spokesperson. I think isn't there a fund like this in Africa? I'm trying to remember. There's a that Neville Isdell's involved with on, it's mainly around, it's around the business enabling environment issues. There's I think it's the ICF, the Investment Climate Fund, which is sort of this touches tangentially on the rule of law issue. It doesn't get at the totality of the issues that I think a U.S. government ought to be pushing, but it sort of, it gets you in the door on some of these issues. But if you had a business lead, you might have, I think this Investment Climate Fund in Africa, I think, is particularly interesting. I think it's actually funded by several member states. I think it's led by DFID, actually, Andrew, if I recall correctly, right? It's a British. Right, and so I'm not going to put Andrew on the spot to tell us all the finer points of it, but I do recall it's a Monday morning, or no, it feels like Monday morning. It's Thursday morning, but it's in terms of all the details. But you should take a look at that. But I think in some ways it may not be that you need business money so much as business voice,
right,
to say, look, this is good. I can tell you, Ethiopia, if you honor property rights, this is going to be good for foreign direct investment. And to have somebody that's much more credible than having an international bureaucrat, though I know some of my best friends are international bureaucrats, right? But to have someone like that deliver that message is oftentimes much more powerful.
I didn't answer one of your questions. Why not have what you would see as the flexibility of using existing institutions, AID and so on? It's always a concern about creating duplication. As a one-time and enduring UN specialist, you know, one sees that. In fact, that's what Bruce Jones is talking about in some of these rule of law programs, even within the UN. My own view is that we really need a partnership to be flexible, that the very purpose of having a partnership is to create something that's nimble, that can take advantage of existing programs, complement them, not displace them, and be able to get around member state politics and surge money to some places, fill gaps that are harder to pull off by some other institutions. But if you sit at AID, or you sit at the UN Democracy Fund, or you sit at UNDP, you might well think, Lagon's idea is going to,
cannibalize
my ox. But I don't.
I'm thinking more of governments that would be deciding why put the money
there.
We have AID, and we have USDA,
DRL,
and we have Ex-Im Bank, and they have tons and tons of money. MCC, why do we not focus our priority on rule of law through those institutions as opposed. I'm not thinking, I have no stake at AID at all, but I'm thinking more of the people that are going to fund it.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't it also be important to reinforce that priority within those institutions?
Do you want to comment on that?
No, why don't we just bring in,
okay.
Bring in
okay.
others? Your point's well taken.
I want to put my friend Stuart on the spot. Stuart, do you want to? You came in a little bit late,
I'm from NCC, so
great. You're my heroes.
Yes. The rubber hits the road.
You guys are in the thick of that.
Yeah, and but if you want to be selective on the governmental side, but for countries that clearly do not have the political will, then you tilt more to the NGO side, so that you're not just throwing out the ones who aren't at the high end, heading in the direction you like.
Yeah.
That's admittedly one of the difficulties of NCC. It's a difficulty and it's a strength. It exists to both reward those who are doing could do both, but having kind of governmental focus plus a NGO or private sector.
Yeah, well, having played my small part in getting the idea of a UN democracy fund into a President Bush speech and pushing for a high proportion of the grants to go to NGOs, that second track, I think, is essential as an option.
David, can I put you on the spot? Since you're here, it's great to see you.
You haven't memorized my paper, David?
But I will. Can I just pick up on your point about the OPICs, XMs, TBAs, and how I agree, MCC already does this, but and how they should bring in rule of law issues into their considerations of making decisions. Is that really I see that in part because given some of the decisions they made in certain countries, they
like ones you follow?
Yes, the ones I follow, and ones I used to follow before I joined the government, back in the 90s with Russia and other countries where they are actually helping the bad regimes, not hurting.
If you accept this dichotomy as being valuable, having a two-track system and making sure there's funding for NGOs, et cetera. I do think MCC and any of the Iraq World Bank or whatever would be trying to make their efforts as effective from a policy perspective.
I put MCC in a totally different category. MCC now uses these hard indicators. I'm talking more about the trade promotion agencies. Where rule of law should matter.
Yeah.
So Thelma, ask you. Used to run U.S. Trade and Development Agency at the OECD. So just what was when you had to work with a whole series of middle income countries, some which had better rule of law than others, and you had to make calls about whether we were going to work in a China or a Malaysia or a Indonesia. certainly there you had to balance a number of different factors in terms of you're helping to promote jobs in the United States, we're trying to help get development done, but also balancing that. And at the same time, I know you had a number of programs under your remit that also did have some enabling environment components to it, some technical assistance to them to help them improve how they were working.
Absolutely, and I think actually you're totally wrong. I think these organizations, for the most part, I mean, Small Business Administration, maybe not, and XM, of course, has an expert orientation, but MCC, AID, USTDA do have a policy focus that they try to build their grant programs around. I know you're frustrated with AID because it gives out, you know, tons of money and then they do their own thing. But we actually had a policy objective on rule of law, which we built technical assistance grants as well as capacity building grants as well as business facilitation grants around that objective.
Thelma, could you just talk about an example of that, if I could put you on the spot just a little bit? Not totally fair. You have to rack your brains. This is about 7 or 8 years ago.
We did bribery and corruption and capacity building and banking. We did some agrarian, and these were with governments who we worked with to identify this as a priority that they had, facilitating agrarian identification so that people could buy and sell property and have value there, and anti-corruption efforts, et cetera. But it was, and then we had a trade capacity building kind of policy portfolio as well, aviation development portfolio as well. So if anything, I think the package was built around policy objectives in order to try to create sustainability and results. But to the extent that you just have money and you don't know where it's going, and you've got, I guess what I'm saying is that for those organizations that have big piles of money, USTDA has had very little small. Money, and so we had an incentive to try to make it work better, is that whether you create a separate facility or not, I think it would be valuable to create a consensus around a modeling, like you said, your concentric circles, mm-hmm. that we kind of guide these organizations who maybe want to have a, or already do have in some cases, a rule of law interest, a priority. Mm-hmm. But where do you best start? What is the best way to go about it and build these concentric circles so that you have the first things done first and they actually reinforce the next thing that you do in the next
thing. Well, I think the place you need to begin is to look at those who are working on rule of law and make sure that if you create some sort of global trust or so a partnership fund, that there is, you know, substantial consultation about how it's shaped with those mm-hmm. with those players, so that it isn't just, you know, kind of willfully adding another layer.
Let me just, I think there is this tension on, for instance, I was at the World Bank Group at IFC for a couple of years, and we were doing work in Belarus, which is my absolute least favorite countries in all time. What I really think, I have a dream of drinking espressos with Andrei Sannikov in a post Lukashenko Belarus out in, you know, when we have freedom in Belarus. So I am really seized by this, I found it personally distasteful that the World Bank Group was providing investments or supporting, you know, investing in Belarus, is such a horrible regime. So I understand, David. I think what you're putting your finger on is that issue, which is, okay, how are we supporting? Should we be? How do the counter argument? And to some extent, I understand that there's a tension here, and I think it's reflected in various parts of the U.S. government and even in the multilateral system. Is okay. Well, the World Bank people would say, well, look, if we can help create a middle class, that's going to create a clamor for rights, or we're going to create a space, an independent space, or private sector that's not dependent on the government. Isn't that a good thing? And I was deeply conflicted. I didn't, you know, I promptly left and handed in my laissez-passer because I didn't know what to do. But the point is, I think, David, I think you put your finger on Thelma, to some extent, what you were talking about, this dichotomy, or sort of that you in essence put your finger on it originally, and then David, then I think you've built on it. So I think this is something for you to think about, Mark, which is, okay, if we're going to work in tough places, because in some ways what you want to do is work in the places that need help or need the help. But how do you do it in ways that don't necessarily reinforce bad actors? How do you do it in ways, or how do you balance that with other sorts of goals that we have, whether it's individually as a country, whether it's, say, jobs or development, a broad definition of development or a broad definition of trade or economic prosperity, with what I think is, David, what you didn't hear, and Stuart, what you didn't hear, is that we just got a grant from the Smith Richardson Foundation to look at the DG-EG nexus. So one of the reasons I was very seized with having Mark come is I see this as sort of, I think the theory's all there, but the bureaucratics stuff around this is actually the problem. It isn't about people not agreeing, these aren't important. It's, there's different flavors of money, there's different bureaucracies, there are different cultures. They don't necessarily, we have 19 agencies that do assistance just in the USG. And the World Bank, when they think, they touch on this on a tangential way through some of the doing business stuff and the fiat stuff, but they don't want to touch democracy. They don't, and governance they'll play with up until a point because it gets into some of these thornier, more tricky things. So I actually think the exchange we just had is actually very pregnant and very important. Because I think this is going to be something, Mark, that isn't going to go away. This is actually a very valid dilemma that I think that we're going to have. But I think we should pursue this. I do think my view is, as having been somebody who was at AID and likes AID for all of its flaws, I'm one of the people in town that actually thinks it ought to be strengthened, and doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't have other actors around the table. I just think that we ought to have a strong and competent AID. And I'm not saying anyone doesn't feel the same way. I'm just saying that I think that, but at the same time, I do think if you could structure this right, I think this is going to be a problem. If you want to do this as a UN type thing and you want them to go to tough, difficult places, it may be that you house this at the World Bank Group, or it may be that you house this at some place where you...
I'm not necessarily, by the way, to counter what you said earlier, suggesting that this should sit at the UN.
Okay, fair enough. So I think you could have, there are a number of places this could be reside. I could frankly see this on, I could see that the right democracy promotion NGO, not that, I'd want to, okay. But I do think you could house this in a number of interesting places. But I do think this dichotomy and this dilemma isn't going to go away. But David, you just please. You'll be getting an invite.
Great.
Yeah.
I look forward to it. But there is this dilemma of dealing with certain regimes, whether it's the Belaruses or the Uzbekistans or the Kazakhstans, where the leaders and governments in these places, some would argue, are just incapable inherently of moving in a more democratic direction. They are not interested in rule of law. They're interested in capture and personal enrichment and rule through corruption and severe repression. So it does raise the question about, can you help build rule of law in country?
Tell me what you think, because we had a feisty debate. Is this a paper went through some drafts with Jim Lindsay and Richard Haass? Jim Lindsay, the director of studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Richard Haass, they're kind of rail politickers, and they ask tough questions of the idealist Lagon. So how are you going to work in non-permissive environments? So if you were to critique the idea of a partnership fund that focuses on rule of law, would you say that you should go the route that Stuart suggests, which is kind of two tracks? You work with governments where there's will, and then you work with civil society where there isn't. Or would you even just stay out of the places where there is no will whatsoever in the government?
I would follow that.
Okay. Oh, of course. Of course.
But in the more repressive regimes around the world, to me, I'm not biased, obviously, coming from Freedom House, I don't see how you can work with governments at all.
No, but you,
that
you,
work,
you
it, act- it works for me, David. That's yeah. okay.
You actually have a category that you publish about the worst of the worst, and so. So.
Absolutely, I'm with you.
I have more questions for my friend David, but I can pick his brain over lunch at any time.
Yeah, there are other folks in the room that I would like to bring in. Who else has thoughts and views on this? Yes, please. Please just identify yourself.
Sure. There. I'm Kritika Lawani Booz Allen Hamilton. I have a quick question going along with the themes of oppressive regimes. That's a good point. Mm-hmm. My thought is, so there's a link that I see is the incentive for a potential global trust for rule of law is the fact that you will have more economic prosperity, which is great. But what about in a scenario of the Gulf states that already have economic prosperity and there's no really incentive to, you know, change the rule of law because... Right. And so if they're rich...
So the question is whether you can actually make a case that, you know, fossil fuels will not exist forever for them and that sort of, you know, rentier states, you know, things that are structured on corruption that at some point... that fuel will run out, too, and that they need to think about, you know, what follows. But that is a good question, because there are certain places, and I've got to tell you, one common denominator seems to be, you know, oil reserves. I mean, it's really remarkable, but, you know, sort of petro-autocracies. And, you know, one of the reasons is Venezuela, and one of the reasons that Russia can have the mixed bag on... democratic governance that they have is because of those riches.
We need more Norways.
Exactly, more Norways, less Venezuelas. Exactly. Other comments. Thank you. I think that's a very valid and interesting point. Others.
Andrew,
double dipping.
Yeah. Sorry. No, apologies in advance for that.
We're friends. It's part of the special relationship with the UK.
It's such an interesting topic. I can't resist. I suppose one question I have is coming back to, I'm always a bit skeptical about any new institution, and so I suppose to justify the creation of a new institution, you have to have a really strong case about what value does it add, what does it do that existing mechanisms, and there's loads of them on the field of rule of law, aren't doing. So I suppose, can you say more about that? You know, is it about additional funding? Is it about actually political will? And will a multilateral institution help in delivering political will? What actually do you see as the real value added of this trust?
Yeah, I think that's I think you've put your fingers on it. I mean, why don't we just plus up DRL and say we're going to have a debt? We're going to go to the U.S. Congress and say we're going to get $150 million a year. Why do this? Now I could give you my argument, having been on the laissez-passe gravy train at the World Bank Group for a while. I could say there's a lot of plus to that in the sense that you can sort of bring others along and provide some additional, let's call it moral suasion or moral authority to something that, you know, reflects a U.S. interest or a U.S. value. That would be my take. But, Mark, you will have a different one.
Well, my hope is to take things to a whole other level of resources, you know, by adding this institution. And that I think, you know, almost – every one of the existing institutions has a certain equity that binds it, you know, whether it be, you know, some of the leading development agencies of national governments or the United Nations. And I, you know, my thought is to create something that elides those, you know, parochial interests. It is not only an effort to try and sort of raise this issue to being, you know, central, you know, war on, you know, lack of rule of law, but also to change a political will situation. I actually think an audience for political will that's as important as the governments in the developing world that, you know, where you hope there'll be more rule of law, are those states with capacity or rising powers in the world, the Brazils, the Turkeys, the Indonesias. I actually think we have I'm a student of global governance. I teach about it. There's all this talk about the rising powers, the BRICS and others. My friends at the Center for New American Security are looking at these swing states of Turkey, Indonesia, Brazil, and India, they need to make an imprint on the world and global governance. And I think this could help supply for them an agenda that isn't entirely an American-style democracy agenda, but that they could help other developing countries. It would be great to create a dynamic of the risen of the global south assisting the not yet risen.
If you said that, knowing a little bit about Brazil, I'm skeptical about them. I could see the Indonesians doing it more than they seem to be willing to lean forward. So my candidate would be the Indonesians. Could Poland count as a risen? Couldn't we just go to the Poles and just say, let's just do this as Americans and Poles?
You know, as the son of two Polish immigrants, I'm sold. But
oh, good.
I mean, they're pushing their own European endowment.
Yeah. Just if you'd identify yourself, please.
Jason Epstein, South 5 Strategies. Mark, you indicated a $120 million initial investment by...
$140.
Considering the battles we've witnessed over the building that the United States Institute for Peace put up, just the cost of that building, I mean, there is no sum of money that won't be bickered over in the United States Senate. You talked about doubters among the realist camp. What do you say to Rand Paul, Tom Coburn, and other budget hawks? How does, you may think $140 million is very modest, but they couldn't care less if you said $140 million or $1.4
billion. So you'd first have to tell them what at least $140 million would come out of. Clearly the case I would make, you know, is here are other places you could turn, and we must not, you know, pardon me, you know, for saying, but we must not turn to the UN to do this, you know, there, and you know, this is the way to do it, that we can actually have something that is, you know, an efficacious partnership. But it would be a tough sell, and I think it would require, you know, some people who are... who are seen as budget hawks going and talking to them about it.
Let me just jump in on that, because I think you're actually portraying a very interesting topic. I think, Mark, one of the things that it's very hard, the measurement and evaluation question on governance, the measurement and evaluation on democracy promotion, the measurement and evaluation question around role of law, I think, I mean, there have been some interesting, there was this interesting longitudinal study that AID did over 20 years looking at democracy promotion in difficult places and how, after, if they were there for several years in terms of supporting democracy promotion work, that even after they left, there was a direct correlation, statistically significant correlation on the move on the Freedom House indicators. You may have seen the study. This was done by Tulane, I think. But I do think, Mark, that in this budget environment, I think you put your finger on something, which is, it's in my mind, the $30 billion that we're spending on official development assistance where this would be living, I think we're at the top of the – we're at best flat over the next 5 years in my mind, or slight decreases, just because everybody else in the Development Assistance Committee, the DAC, the Major League Baseball Commission of Donors, except for our friends in the United Kingdom and maybe one or two others, are increasing. But I think – I'm not sure that they can defy gravity forever. I do not believe the United States. And so I do think this is true. So I think there's two thoughts. One is you're going to have a hell of a lot of in addition to this, you're going to have a hell of a lot of smart studies that back up the if you make money investments in this, this is what we're going to get for it. And then you probably yourself probably can't say, well, we'll take it out of the microfinance earmark or take it out of the someone else's sacred cow.
Someone else
I've got opinions. I've got opinions of where you could take it from, but I won't say them publicly. But I do think. That's a separate conversation, but I do think there is going to be a zero-sum game coming. I've been particularly concerned, and I'm actually, David, I'm working with John Podesta on a bipartisan statement with Madeleine Albright and Vin Weber about protecting or sustaining investments in democracy and governance. And because I think, given that it sits in the development assistance account, if you're getting into the aid lingo here, it's particularly vulnerable because nobody's going to cut ARVs to AIDS, people suffering from AIDS, because you're going to kill people. It's a global entitlement at the moment. Not, beyond the fact it's a great thing and it's wonderful, it's political suicide. So there's certain things where you just can't touch because of various things. So I think one of the reasons I wanted to host you is because I think this is worth, if there was an opportunity to rejigger our aid portfolio, I'd rejigger it towards this. So we need to be, if the opportunity were to present itself, we're going to need to have some studies to back it up and to think through that. But I also think, you don't have to figure out where it's going to come from, because that's a different kind of a conversation. But we could brainstorm about that offline. How about that? Yes.
I mean, perhaps also it's therefore important to get commitments in advance or simultaneously with the budget request, commitments from the outside to demonstrate that it's not a USG go it alone approach.
Matching.
Yeah.
Commitments.
Let me just get, Delma, would you want to make an additional comment?
I think the question to answer first is the Divid question. How do you make the case for this entity? If somebody comes in and says, I have $500 million on Divid, why should we give it to you? This facility. And so the Divid question is, how do you make this, why is this the place to put it? What makes this the most effective place to put it? And then it makes it a lot easier to sell it there to get them to find the funding for it.
Well, why don't we take one more question or comment? I see a lot of thoughtful, shy people. I'm not one of them. I'm thoughtful but not shy. So, but who has not spoken yet that might want to say something? And we'll give you the last word. Okay. Okay.
While you're thinking of that, I have one question to ask of David. So, how would you deal with this issue of? Is promotion of rule of law something that undercuts the democracy agenda? Some people, is emphasizing this, does it, I'm not talking about threatening funding for that, although that might be another issue, but, if you're going to do the time, should
message?
You do the crime? Should you be, completely straightforward about, democracy and governance? I'm one who is, happy to begin, hearing President Obama refer to democracy more explicitly after, the previous president. Do you think this is a problem of having something that's quite explicitly designed not to be using democracy as the label, the concentric circles idea? Same here.
I know you don't either, right? But I also think promoting rule of law is just as important.
It's delivering on democracy. Or it's part of delivering on democracy.
Well, it's delivering on democracy, but it's also, it's a little bit, maybe to answer your question, Mark, it's coming back to the point you just made here, which is, it isn't just that one day you're going to run out of resources. It is for these kind of repressive regimes, some of which don't need to be overthrown, but they're going to be overthrown if they continue on the path that they're on. Because the corruption feeds more repression, they refuse to give up power, and they suppress minorities and freedom, the whole range of freedoms. And they're going to produce the very kind of scenario that they think they're working against, which is they're going to promote and foment instability in their country, extremism. So pursuing the rule of law path may be something easier for those kind of middle range regimes to pursue rather than democracy.
Right. But I'm just as interested for this purpose of this proposal in the little El Salvador and really big India, which have lingering problems of corruption and whole groups of people who really don't have the access to justice, and assisting countries that are ostensibly robust democracies but could be even more economically vital. I mean, for me, I just think we are so deeply concerned about those who are treated as less than human, who are subject to atrocities and genocide. But there are groups of people that are not treated as fully human because you're a woman or because you're a Dalit, and this is something that really...
Validating democratic
Well, there's a reason why I've not suggested that the United States co-host the meeting on this with India. I think they're unlikely to be the main early champion of this, from my own experience.
Please.
My name is Augusta, and I'm from the International Foundation for Electoral Systems.
Excellent.
And so this conversation is very interesting to me, and you mentioned something about, rule of law initiatives being sort of separate from democracy and governance support, and it's something that we're talking about, next door at our office. The political legitimacy is derived from a person going to the ballot box, right, and casting a vote. In a lot of countries that have a repressive regime, votes are obfuscated by fraud or some other means. Rule of law is intimately tied in here when you have a functioning electoral complaints adjudication process, and that is something that we don't necessarily do but would be supported by a fund like this and is incredibly valuable, I think. So not really a question, just a comment.
No, but just to reinforce, David Kramer's view, this is not an either-or proposition. It's a complementary matter.
Okay, I suspect there are going to be folks that want to chat with you bilaterally, so I'm just thinking that we might want to end this here. And I want to thank you, Mark, for coming in. I'm so pleased that you've put this on the table. I think this has a lot of promise, and I hope that this discussion helps sharpen your thinking.